Thank you everyone for joining us for the Rail Journal podcast. My name is Jasmohan Bajaj. I'm the co-editor-in-chief. So along with my co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Millie Long, we're delighted to have Dr. Mateen Memo, who is an assistant professor of biostatistics, gastroenterology, epidemiology, and bioinformatics from University of Pennsylvania. And he was the lead and corresponding author of the recently published guideline, Perioperative Risk Assessment and Management in Patients with Cirrhosis, that is currently online in the Rare Journal. Welcome, Dr. Memo.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's jump right into it. This guideline goes into a lot of details about a very important topic that a lot of our patients with cirrhosis face, either emergently or at some point non-emergently as well. So what are the key elements of surgical risk assessment that you want clinicians to focus on, especially those who don't do this day in and day out and may have a patient with cirrhosis that they're seeing occasionally that may need it?
Yeah, I think it's an important question. Obviously, I think it's well known that patients who have cirrhosis do have increased risk of surgeries, and they have a higher risk of dying during or after surgery. But when you kind of dig down a little bit deeper and try to understand what are the specific factors that contribute to that risk, I like to think of it in terms of three different buckets, and this is the way that we present this in the guidelines. We think about the cirrhosis-related factors, of course, which is severity of liver disease, degree of portal hypertension, decompensation, is there sarcopenia, malnutrition, hemostatic derangements, things along these lines. But you also have to consider, of course, the non-hepatic patient factors. So the patient's demographics, their BMI, their lifestyle factors. Are they heavy alcohol users? Is there significant tobacco exposure? What are their non-hepatic comorbidities? Do they have heart failure? Do they have COPD? Those things, of course, factor into the operative risk. And I think the third bucket that may have been historically underappreciated, but I think is very important to consider, are the surgery-specific factors. So what type of surgery is planned? What's the complexity? Is it laparoscopic? Is it open? Is it an emergency surgery? And where is the surgery being performed? Is it going to be performed at a high volume center that's very experienced with a very experienced anesthesiology teams who know how to manage the very complicated hemodynamics of patients with cirrhosis? Or is it being performed in a less experienced center? So those three buckets are the way I like to think of it. So the cirrhosis factors, the non-liver related patient factors, and the surgical factors.
Thank you so much. And this, for those who are also visual learners, this is figure two as well. Indeed. So that's very important to have these three factors that are not only cirrhosis specific. And of course, we need to talk to the surgeons as well. Are there any specific tools that the clinicians can use? And of course, these clinicians could be surgeons, would be APPs, would be people who are basically prepping the patient for surgery or considering this as well. So what are these tools and where are they available?
Yeah, so I think the best known tools that most who are probably familiar with are things like the MELD score, MELD sodium, the Child-Turcotte Pugh score. These scores have obviously been around for a long time to give an assessment of the severity of liver disease, and they have been studied specifically in surgical settings. Though I would say they're not really designed specifically to give you discrete predictions of operative risk for patients with cirrhosis. Fortunately, there are other tools that have been developed for that purpose. One was the Mayo Cirrhosis Surgical Risk Score, or the Mayo Risk Score, which is available on the Mayo website. That's been around for some time. It was kind of put together in the early to mid 2000s. And it does give you very specific predicted probabilities of postoperative mortality at different time points, which is very useful. However, the most modern tool that's been published is one that I was involved in collaborating on the production of. This is something called the Vocal Pen Score. The reason why I think the vocal pen score features prominently in this guideline is it's derived from more modern data from more types of surgeries. And in contrast to the Mayo risk score, the vocal pen score also specifically has a field for the type of surgery that's being performed, which I think is very important. You don't get that from MELD score, Child-Pugh, or the Mayo risk score. So if a patient is getting, a triple vessel bypass surgery with an open valve replacement, the Mayo risk score would give you the same estimated risk as a knee replacement. And obviously the risks differ dramatically. So the vocal pen score is available at vocalpenscore.com. So MD Calc is a very common place to just access the MELD score or Child-Turcotte Pugh score, but those are readily available. So I think those four tools are commonly used in practice. We recommend looking at all of these tools, though I think the most current and I think best validated in the modern era of surgical practice is likely to be the vocal pen score.
Thank you. And I can vouch for this. I've used it multiple times and so have my trainees. So thank you for doing that. And of note, it was first in the veteran population. That's why VOCAL, which is an acronym. And then you did validate it outside the VA population as well. So thank you for that. These are very important take-home points. But there are some subsets of patients with compensated cirrhosis whom we would not normally think that they would have excess risk with surgery. What are those patients and what should we do with those patients?
Yeah, this was a kind of an interesting area that when we were actually working on publishing the vocal pen score, this kind of came up frequently, that we had identified some patients who have cirrhosis, but nonetheless appeared to have fairly low operative risk, even for major surgeries, and were actually classified as ASA classification 2 by the anesthesiologists. So historically, I think, you know, we think of patients with cirrhosis as, you know, they're going to have an ASA score, American Society of Anesthesiology physical classification, I should define that, an ASA score of at least 3, and if they're decompensated, it's a 4. What we found is that in reality, anesthesiologists in the VA, there were quite a few patients who were classified as an ASA 2. When we look at those patients, they're patients who, imagine having a patient who had hepatitis C-related cirrhosis that's very well compensated. They've had their hepatitis C treated and cured, and they really have no other major medical comorbidities. These patients really do have minimally increased operative risk attributable to their cirrhosis. And so those are the types of patients who oftentimes were classified as ASA 2. So I think the point here is that just because you have cirrhosis, it doesn't inherently mean that you're going to have extremely high operative risk. There are these lower risk phenotypes of patients with very well compensated cirrhosis, especially those who have had their etiology of liver disease removed and they don't have any other major non-hepatic comorbidities that would really impact their operative risk. Those patients, you can almost think of them as having, you know, similar risk stratification to a general medicine patient who didn't have cirrhosis.
This would automatically include people with a recompensation, which means they do not have any ascites and are not on medications for it, not had a TIPS, including people who had had encephalopathy before, but neither are lactose or rifaximin. They would potentially classify this, but this is something that you're looking at.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, the concept of recompensation, at least in its current conception, kind of postdated a lot of this type of literature and certainly postdated the derivation of these scores. So I don't think that's been looked at specifically through that lens of recompensation. I think that's likely the case, though I don't think those patients are quite the same as patients who have always been well compensated who then had their etiology of liver disease removed. There might be some gradation of risk. So I couldn't tell you confidently that those patients are exactly the same. But it's a really, I think, important area of future study.
The guidelines suggest that patients with the projected 90-day mortality above 15% should be considered for simultaneous or transplant evaluation before elective surgery. How did that threshold come into play, and what if a patient is not a transplant candidate?
Yeah, so I'll admit that the threshold is not entirely arbitrary, but it's not necessarily based on empiric evidence. This is a number that had appeared in some prior expert guidance, and we thought it was a reasonable threshold. It's certainly not gospel. So, I mean, if a patient had a projected, you know, 90-day mortality of 14%, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider transplant evaluation before surgery. But we thought it was important to include something here to signal to the clinician that if a patient with cirrhosis does have a pretty significant risk of postoperative mortality and postoperative decompensation, there should be some thought given to whether that patient needs or should go undergo a preoperative transplant evaluation if they're otherwise a potential candidate. Because if they do decompensate after surgery, you don't want to be rushing to do a last-minute transplant evaluation. You want to have done the homework ahead of time. So that's the rationale for this. But again, the 15% is, it's really kind of an expert opinion, what we think is reasonable, but it's absolutely not a directive.
And a patient could argue that there's 85% chance that I'm not going to die. And therefore, if a patient is not a transplant candidate, which unfortunately occurs more often than not, I think this important thing about this guideline is it gives people a lot of leeway to have an individualized discussion, not only between the patient and the medical doctor like us, but also between the patients and the surgeon. And it's nice that you actually have a surgeon also involved in this guideline. Were there any unique insights brought by the surgeon that maybe people like you and I, as GI or physician, would not automatically have that would actually inform the guidelines, help you formulate some of these concepts?
Yeah, so Dr. McElroy was the surgeon on this guideline, and she was extremely helpful and had a lot of important insights, I think, that shaped the way we think about some of this. I think your point about kind of having this overarching emphasis that I think the guideline kind of comes together to emphasize shared decision-making and multidisciplinary kind of coordination of care. And I think the perspective I had from Dr. McElroy in part was that surgeons might be a little bit less familiar with some of the tools that we're talking about here. And they become aware of that through conversation with gastroenterologists or hepatologists, providers who are kind of identifying indications for surgery potentially in patients they're caring for who have cirrhosis. She also, I think, had a lot of insight for some of the surgery-specific considerations, and we chose to have a dedicated section addressing specific scenarios like the abdominal hernia repair, cholecystectomy, bariatric surgery. Some of these have more limited evidence base than others, but from a surgical standpoint, I think some of the nuances of those procedures are so different from a surgical standpoint that we felt it was important to incorporate a lot of what available literature there was to have discussions and some concepts at least related to unique considerations that largely came from Dr. McElroy.
Yeah, and also in the perioperative risk assessment management highlights guideline that has now come out, you can also see these three of these surgeries, cholecystectomy, bariatric surgery, and hernia repair, where there's specific focus on this because these are maybe not directly, but tangentially related to our patients with cirrhosis. So I'm glad that everyone was able to put their heads together and come up with some kind of, at least, if not statement, concepts around these. Moving ahead, there are also some things with a lot of focus on tips before surgery, with this transjugular intrahepatic portal system in shunt to reduce portal hypertension. And here, I think you kind of hedged your bets and said if someone would automatically require tips rather than people who were getting tips purely for the surgery or the intervention itself. Is it possible for you to lead us through your thought process as to when you came to this concept?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a really challenge. This is probably the biggest point of contention from the guideline panel. We went back and forth quite a bit on exactly the wording and even the strength of the recommendation. But I think it is a bit of a hedge that we describe that we think that selected patients should be considered for TIPS, especially if it's a major abdominal surgery or a major thoracic or chest surgery. These are surgeries that I think most directly kind of impede on the territory that's affected by portal hypertension the most. But we especially recommend considering this in patients who have some alternative indication for TIPS, like refractory ascites, for instance. So it does feel like a hedge, but I think it's reflective of the state of the literature. So all the studies are retrospective. We have no prospective studies to really look at this question. And when we look closely at the retrospective studies that are available, there are some good studies out there, mostly from Europe, that demonstrate that preoperative TIPS compared to no preoperative TIPS, it's been associated with a reduction in postoperative mortality, in hospital mortality, even reductions in postoperative acute on chronic liver failure. So it seems very appealing. However, when you dig into the methods of some of these studies, and this might be getting too in the weeds, but I think it's important, a lot of the multivariable adjustment or matching is done based on immediate preoperative labs comparing TIPS and no TIPS patients. And an analysis that we recently published from the Veterans Health Administration, so a large national data set, we actually matched patients 6 months prior to surgery. So before anybody had a TIPS, they looked equivalent based on a propensity score match. And then we followed patients who had a TIPS or those who did not have a TIPS. And the patients who had a TIPS, they on average, they had worse liver synthetic function immediately prior to surgery. And we actually found an increased risk of postoperative mortality attributable to the TIPS group. So I think the thing that what might have been missed in previous studies is that they're adjusting away some of the liver synthetic dysfunction that can happen after a TIPS. We know that TIPS has risk. It takes blood flow away from their liver. It increases the risk of hepatic encephalopathy. It's not a benign intervention. So I think there really is a nuanced risk-benefit consideration that has to be considered. Mitigating the portal hypertension obviously reduces operative risk, but that comes at the price of some degree of hepatic reduction in blood flow and reduced liver synthetic function that may increase operative risk. So based on that, we really could not give a strong recommendation to just uniformly consider TIPS in patients who have portal hypertension. I think it needs to be more nuanced and ideally really focused at centers that have expertise in TIPS and cirrhosis care.
Thank you. And this again brings it back to the individualization of each and every patient's risk benefit ratio and their acceptance of potential hepatic encephalopathy after elective TIPS. And again, sticking to if they need a TIPS, then potentially wait till that TIPS, perioperative TIPS procedure has kind of subsided and then go to a surgery. If that surgery, of course, can wait. One of the few places where we do have some kind of grade A evidence or a little higher evidence is on thrombopoietin receptor agonists. And these are important because a lot of the surgical and non-surgical interventions are driven by not only the platelet count, but the platelet function, which are both compared in patients with liver disease and cirrhosis specifically. So what is the current role of thrombopoietin receptor agonists who need surgery in patients with thrombocytopenia and cirrhosis?
Yeah, so we had a strong recommendation here because there actually is some randomized controlled trial evidence supporting this. But basically, you know, patients who have severe thrombocytopenia, which we defined as less than 50,000, which is a pretty commonly used threshold in the literature, if they're undergoing high risk procedures or surgeries, giving the thrombopoietin receptor agonist in advance of surgery will stimulate the bone marrow to increase the platelet count. And this was in trials demonstrated to reduce the need for perioperative transfusions, and from other meta-analyses, reduce the risk of perioperative bleeding as well. So that's the basis for the recommendation. The pragmatic side of things is you have to plan this a little bit because these TPO receptor agonists, they don't work immediately. You can't give it the day before the day of surgery. It takes time to stimulate the bone marrow to produce platelets. So this, these usually have to be given, or you have to start them in advance, 5 to 10 days, depending on the medication and the dosing regimen, to make sure that the peak in platelet count coincides with the timing of surgery. But yes, in patients who have severe thrombocytopenia, there's evidence to suggest, reduction in transfusions, reduction in bleeding risk, and so we think it's reasonable.
Thank you. So the guideline recommends referral to high volume or transplant centers for major surgeries and cirrhosis. What is the evidence, and how should clinicians decide when referrals make sense? It would advise a lot of our listeners and our readers to take care of patients with cirrhosis, but may not necessarily be associated per se with a transplant center. What are specific recommendations in which type of patients / which type of surgeries that you would actually give those by and large? I know this still is an individualized process, but what are the top few things that you might consider where surgery may not be okay in a community center where they don't have that much experience with surgery?
Yeah. So to answer the first part of the question, there is, so of course, there's lots of broad surgical literature that centers that are high volume centers and performing a particular type of surgery have better outcomes than centers that are low volume. Like there's a lot of literature, for instance, for hernia surgeries in this regard. But recently there was a study published in the last year that demonstrated this specifically in patients with cirrhosis, again, in the Veterans Health Association administration, that high volume centers had lower postoperative mortality as compared to low volume centers that are less experienced. And there are many reasons why I think this is likely the case, but I think your practical question of, does this need to be the case for every single patient with cirrhosis? Probably not. And I think the factors that should push you more towards an urgency to refer a patient to a high volume experienced center are related to the risk factors we talked about. So, patients that have demonstrated portal hypertension who are decompensated, and I think in terms of surgery types, the major abdominal surgeries, major chest and thoracic surgeries in particular, I think are among the highest risk, as well as cardiac surgeries. So I think it's a combination of the patient phenotype and the type of surgery that would push someone to more sort of fervently kind of moving with that recommendation. And we also in the guidelines did distinguish between hepatic surgeries and non-hepatic surgeries for this particular part of the text, because there is more literature specifically in hepatic surgeries that patients undergoing liver resection, in particular, there's a stronger evidence base that should be performed at a higher volume center if possible. So that would be the other unique consideration.
And again, to remind our listeners, these are only for elective surgeries. If you have an emergent surgery, you have to do whatever you have to do.
Yes, of course.
In addition to the things that are potentially out of the medical person's control, like type of surgery here, surgeon award, et cetera, there are things that are in our control, or at least we can advise the patients what to do, which is keeping them current with their cirrhosis management, like ascites control, variceal prophylaxis, HCC screening. So why is this such an important part of reducing risk of potential elective surgery?
Yeah, I think in general, historically, there's not been a whole lot of literature on risk mitigation techniques and approaches to reduce the risk of operative death in these patients. But that is certainly where the literature is shifting and where there's more evidence base being built. And so in the past 2 years, there was a study that was published demonstrating that patients with cirrhosis who underwent a major surgery, patients who had a preoperative visit with a gastroenterologist or hepatologist and with a primary care physician, there's sort of a synergistic benefit to being seen by these providers in advance of a surgery. And when you dig into the data a bit deeper, there are actual changes in medical management that are occurring after these visits. So for instance, patients who were seen by hepatology or gastroenterology providers before surgery were more likely to have their diuretics titrated. They're more likely to have their lactulose or rifaximin titrated or initiated. They were more likely to have preoperative paracentesis, or if there were indications for SPP prophylaxis, that was more likely to be initiated. So what we were seeing was patients who were being routinely seen and seen close to a surgery, they were basically having kind of best practice management of their cirrhosis decompensations addressed. So I think optimizing decompensations before surgery intuitively makes sense, but there's evidence building that this actually makes a difference. So we need to thoroughly assess, you know, if patients need diuretics, do they need to be tweaked? Do they have encephalopathy that needs to be managed? Do they, you know, do they need a non-selective beta blocker to manage, you know, variceal prophylaxis if they have clinically significant portal hypertension? All of those things I think need to be addressed, as well as cancer screening, because obviously if you identify a new HCC, that could change the whole conversation around a particular surgery or prognosis. So all of those elements are incredibly important. And I think, again, these are areas of important future study to identify like what specific things in terms of risk mitigation really impact operative risk the most.
And of course, in addition to all of this, the usual, making sure the etiology of the disease is under control, alcohol and tobacco cessation as much as possible, as well as rehabilitation and nutrition care for these patients. So the hope is to actually make them bring their best body forward for the surgery, body and brain forward for the surgeries, so that they can recover better and have a better outcome. And on behalf of the Red Journal podcast, I thank you, Dr. Nadeem, on behalf of everyone here for such a nice podcast and actually coming through with such a nice and actionable guideline. For the listeners, please look at the guidelines. It goes into details of specific surgeries as well, in addition to giving overviews, and there are links to important scores that Dr. Nadeem mentioned here, the vocal pen score and the Mayo score, which can be used. And if you are the best way of approaching this is to actually put them in your notes so that your surgeons actually see them. And when you put enough of them, the surgeons would actually trickle down to their trainees as well. And if you have multidisciplinary conferences, introduce these routinely to your surgeons as well so that they can use it without you having to make the first step. That's our thing. And I thank everyone for putting this guideline together. Thank you for your time.
Thanks again.